This is Works in Progress, a podcast from the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. I'm Sean Arenas. I recently sat down with UCLA Arts alumnus Zach Blass. Zach is an artist, filmmaker, writer, and professor at the University of Toronto, whose practice spans moving image, computation, theory, performance, and even science fiction. His work often explores the unsettling side of technology, artificial intelligence, and religious zealotry. In this conversation conducted over Zoom, I talked to Zach about his upbringing in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, his initial interest in film, and ultimately what inspired his passion for art and technology, his life-saving experience as a Tori Amos groupie, and his current work and contribution to the exhibition Digital Witness, Revolutions in Design, Photography, and Film at LACMA, part of Getty's region-wide initiative PST Art, Art and Science Collide. For this conversation, we started at the beginning with his upbringing in West Virginia.
Now, I grew up in Appalachia in a coal mining village in West Virginia. And you would think, maybe people that grow up in this part of the world and have a quite, poor working class upbringing, where does art come in? And, would parents be so encouraging to go study art in school? But, Appalachia is, rich with its cultures and its crafts and its music. And it just so happened that even though, all the men in my family, except my father, who's Puerto Rican, and that's like a different story, but they all played musical instruments. And yeah, basically almost everyone in my family played a musical instrument. So actually art for me began with music. And I was trained on the piano from a very young age, from maybe 4 or 5. And then, as I got really into music, I started watching a lot of films because my father was really into cinema. And then, I started noticing the music in film. And as I got older, I became really, really interested in cinema. So this was like the other kind of big step for me with where art came into my life. And I just started to be really attracted to how film brought in music, it brought in imagery, and there were stories. And I wrote a lot of film scripts when I was a teenager. And then, I ended up going to film school, and that's what I studied in my undergraduate education. And I actually really didn't know. I think, when you say contemporary art or something like this, I had no idea what that is when I was younger growing up in West Virginia, because I was so isolated. It was, such a rural place, and we weren't going to see contemporary art and we weren't going to see exhibitions of paintings, really. So my sense of art, I really think I thought art was just like paintings of fruit or something. And I was much more acquainted with music, films, and books. And then, that changed over time, of course, after I left West Virginia and moved to Boston. Go ahead.
Just because I want to talk about Boston and I want to talk about film, but to circle back, so you're come from a family, a lot of musicians. Was this like a family jam type environment? What was the environment if everyone was so many musicians? What was that like?
No, there wasn't a family jam, not really. Although it was more like my great grandparents. Yeah, there might be like the banjo and a harmonica playing together, for instance, but everyone kind of did their own thing. And my mother was a ceramicist, and she would have never considered herself an artist, but she was part of a women's ceramics group and did that on a weekly basis, and basically made all of the decorative objects in our house. So that was another really interesting thing to look back on and think about, how my mom was really creative in her own way. But I remember my parents made me play on a piano, or not a piano, on a keyboard that, was one of these 80s keyboards that, I don't know, was like a foot and a half long. It's tiny. And I had to play on that for maybe 6 years because my parents had to save to buy a piano. And then we bought an upright piano and I just lived on that piano. I mean, it was like my therapist. And I always prided myself as a teenager because I would break 3 to 5 strings a year because I would just play this thing so hard. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, my parents really enjoyed that. But yeah, we were just being like in different parts of the house, you know, playing different instruments. Yeah, that, strangely, there was no jam session.
I asked Zach what inspired him during his teenage years in West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really dark things. If I'm honest, I am attracted. Like, I have this, like, definitely a 90s attraction to certain types of darkness. And there's definitely, like, a Southern goth. You know, West Virginia, it's this funny, it can feel Midwestern, it can feel Southern. And I'm from, like, the southwestern pocket of West Virginia, where Ohio and Kentucky and West Virginia all come together. And, I mean, as a teenager, I was, like, really obsessed with Anne Rice. Mm. And I, you know, was definitely into horror. Probably one of the most important filmmakers for me then was Greg Araki. One of this, mm-hmm. You know, part of new queer cinema, particularly his Teen Apocalypse trilogy. Like, just that, you know, those movies really meant everything to me back then. But also someone like Dennis Cooper, you know, was really... I'm always just amazed. I don't know how I discovered all this stuff in rural West Virginia, but I found it. And I read all of, like, everything that Dennis Cooper had written, you know, he's still writing, but whenever that was in the 90s, like, I was just consuming kind of all of his work. So, yeah, I mean, I think definitely, like, a gay, queer horror. And also, you know, like, I was really attracted to very broke, like, really, like, ornate, like, over the top. I think, you know, like, I love Tori Amos's album Boys for Pele, which is like, you know, it's just so too much. And I kind of can see how all of these different works have definitely, you know, come into play and influence me, even though it's kind of funny because school becomes this site where you often disavow and turn away from, like, all of these kind of early attractions. And I think I'm at a different stage in my life where I've, you know, gone through the schooling and, of course, like, the kind of the training, the exposure, like, all my intellectual interests, like, I've just let everything kind of merge together now. And all of it, like, becomes, yeah, like, a particular kind of stew composition. I don't know what you want to call it. Yeah.
Before art, Zach set out to be a filmmaker, albeit an experimental one. So logically, he went to film school.
This video store, one of the only video stores that I grew up around, strangely had, like, I don't know, Peter Greenaway or, you know, Krzysztof Kieslowski, some of these, you know, kind of luminaries in European cinema of the late 20th century. And, you know, I love their work and was really inspired, again, by, like, the use of music, the use of you know, visual composition, complex stories, working against kind of traditional narrative sometimes. And yeah, that's what I wanted to do because, you know, I just thought film was like, I can bring together all these different creative aspects that I'm really interested in. And when I applied to film school, you know, it was a frustrating process. I mean, I didn't even have a guidance counselor at my high school. And so, and I was the first in my family to go to university. I was very confused about the whole process. No one was really giving me recommendations on what to do or where to look. And I just knew that I wanted to get as far away from West Virginia as possible. And Boston seemed quite far, but, you know, a lot of film programs at the undergraduate level wanted, you know, like, reels. And I didn't have the means to, you know, I wasn't able to make films as a teenager because I didn't have the resources to do so then. And so, I mean, I remember I applied to NYU without a portfolio, even they asked for one. And of course I didn't get in, but Boston University was one of the only film schools that didn't require a portfolio. And you would go through, like, a liberal arts education for 2 years and then start your film training. So, you know, I really lucked out, you know, that someone like me with my background was able to get into that program. And yeah, I think, you know, I just thought, hey, I'm going to do this and become a filmmaker. But that, you know, when I was in film school, there was a different track called television, and television was where kind of video was happening. But if you, at this time, if you were in film school, it was purely analog. So all films were shot, you know, and initially we shot with a Bolex, and then we move, you know, onto like, you know, 8-16 millimeter, and we're editing on a Steenbeck, you know, we're like hand splicing film, working with like Magstock for sound. But coming out of it, I felt like it was just financially impossible. And I had been exposed to digital editing a little. And I think, you know, over time, actually, after I graduated, I stayed in Boston for half a year, and I started taking a like evening class at Mass Art that was, I think it was called interactive or like multimedia installation. And that was like a big click for me. It was my first art class. And, you know, it happened after undergrad. And I was like, oh, I think art is going to be this venue or this place where I can make work, whatever my financial means.
Although film school had Zach shooting on film and editing on a Steenbeck, he saw the writing on the wall. It was the early 2000s, and the future was digital. This technology was economically more accessible and creatively flexible. This led to an interest in computers and digital media.
It really started right after my time in Boston, you know, and taking this multimedia class at Mass Art just exposed me to a lot of, you know, different types of artistic practices. And, you know, I just got really intrigued with the idea of using computers. I barely had a computer growing up, and I, you know, it was still just like kind of foreign to me in many ways. And this is why I spent a year at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago in the Art and Technology Studies program. I did this 1 year program called a post baccalaureate certificate. And, you know, within art and tech, that program, I, you know, took classes on how to build electronics, you know, working with circuits, computer programming, interactive installation. And that's when I just got exposed, I would say, to digital art properly. And I found it really exciting. And at that time, I was really into the idea of like hacking, and I got exposed to media theory. And I think a lot of media theory from the 1990s, like really spoke. It was very experimental. A lot of these scholars and theorists were in conversation with artists, and it just seems like a really exciting terrain. And it just felt new. And it, yeah, I was just really, really taken with it.
And was it at this stage you sort of, the switch flipped and you realized, you know, I'm not going to be a traditional narrative filmmaker. I didn't really set out to be. I was influenced by art house filmmakers, but I'm going to be an artist, a visual artist. You know, when did you sort of arrive at that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just happened naturally by making this decision to go to Chicago, getting, you know, learning more about the history of art, you know, getting exposed to things, you know, like performance art, sound art, video art, and just there's, I don't know if punk isn't really the right word, but I think that is the, there's something of that sentiment that I just felt, because I think what I was so frustrated with my film education was we were, after each level of film production, we were kind of funneled into this traditional filmmaking model, this industry model of making. And I just absolutely hated it, because we had to pitch our storylines to the class, which was, I remember, just filled with a lot of like annoying New York film bros. And they never liked my ideas because they were just so out there. And I never got to make the films I wanted to make in film school. I only got to at the very basic level when we were experimenting on our own with a Bolex, which honestly felt more like art school in that way.
While in Chicago, Zach worked at the Video Data Bank at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, founded in the late 70s by video artists Kate Horsfield and Lynn Blumenthal. The VDB is a resource for video and media art. Zach's time there greatly influenced his work.
I got hired by them because I moved there before I even started school with my boyfriend at the time. And like while he was going to school, I got hired at the Video Data Bank, and I was just working at their front desk. But they have this like absolutely incredible collection, specifically around the early history of video art, you know, work that was coming out like right when video was coming into being, this first wave of video, whether it's like, I don't know, Bruce Nauman or Joan Jonas. And you couldn't take any of this home. Like you would have, as they would like loan to institutions, or you could borrow videos for classes, but they had viewing rooms, and I would just live in these viewing rooms. And I essentially just watched the entire collection, probably over a year and a half. And that really, blew my mind for sure. And introduced me just, again, to lots of different formal techniques, you know, conceptual ways of working with media. And that was just absolutely mind-blowing and phenomenal. I think, you know, then I don't think my artistic sensibility was, I think I was still just really experimenting and absorbing and getting exposed to different things. I remember like learning about the Vienna Actionist when I was in Chicago. It was definitely just a period of, I would say, experimentation and absorbing art. It was great. But I think like, I remember my critiques went really badly at the Art Institute of Chicago. You know, the professors were just like, what the hell? Oh, but there was one important aspect. I took my first queer theory class.
That class, taught by writer and historian David Getzey, inspired Zach to consider combining queer theory with technology. This idea, however, was met with some resistance.
At the time, there was not a lot of examples of that. I had been exposed to like 1990s cyberfeminism, but you know, that was a little different, definitely inspiring. And I remember going and talking to certain professors within the Department of Art and Technology, who's, you know, I cannot name them, but I mean, I would say they were quite homophobic and very anti-queer and really dismissive and just, you know, absolutely hated this idea of bringing queer, like, I mean, just, it was incomprehensible about like, why would you bring something like queerness into the realm of digital art and art and technology? And I do remember just, yeah, being very frustrated that this approach that I wanted to do was just so dismissed and derided. And it's really, but you know, you could say the same thing about a lot of queer art, because I actually experienced it from both angles, where, you know, queer art has its own habits and tendencies. And I also remember hanging out with queer artists in other departments, and they were just equally put off about the idea of bringing in something, you know, seemingly high tech into a queer practice. So I remember feeling like that I was just a little bit stranded in a no man's land, where the other queer artists weren't so interested and the technologists like certainly weren't, and they were like actively hostile. So that was my Chicago experience, and that's why I left after a year, basically.
After completing his post-baccalaureate at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, Zach didn't feel that his education was complete. He applied to a number of grad schools and got into UCLA's Department of Design Media Arts, or DMA.
The appeal of UCLA was a very small cohort, and going back to a research university where you have like all the resources of a research university, that means I'm going to be able to take classes outside of an art context. The library is going to be more resourced. There were a lot of, and you know, I think after going through Chicago winter, I was like, I'm ready to get out of this.
And had you been to Los Angeles at all prior to UCLA?
Once. This is a whole other tangent, which we will not have time to get into. But when I was a teenager, I ran away from home for like on and off for like 2 years. And I was a Tori Amos groupie, and I followed Tori Amos, this musician, around the country. And I ended up in Los Angeles because I saw a Tori Amos concert like in Irvine. And the funny thing about that story is that I just remember that Gwyneth Paltrow and Elizabeth Shue literally sat in front of me for that show.
And as I have to ask a little bit more though. So as a Tori Amos groupie, are you with other groupies? Are you actually part of the Tori Amos crew?
No, there was a crew. There was a group. We were not with the crew, but there was a group that, you know, during the 90s, she had a very queer following. And I mean, you know, there just certain types of people were attracted to her, and it was like a perfect storm for me of things. And it was amazing. And, you know, doing this while I was in high school just kind of saved my life. And yeah, like I just, you know, I was like the child in this group because everyone else was older than me. People were in their like mid to late 20s. I was the only teenager. And I just remember I never had any money and everyone just paid for me to like be around. I mean, it was pretty incredible. And we always got tickets, usually from Tori. Like she would distribute free tickets to her shows for like these people that were following.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I mean, yeah, I mean, seriously, I can't even remember like how did I even get a plane ticket to go to LA when I was like probably like 17 years old. I don't even remember, but I do know that I did it. But that was my only time. No, I really didn't know hardly anything about LA when I moved there. And I had basically never driven a car my entire life at that point.
It's now 2006. Zach is at UCLA. Founded in 2000, DMA was a relatively new department that then and now takes a multidisciplinary approach to artistic practice and focuses on creative experimentation, particularly with technology. I asked him what he hoped to accomplish at UCLA.
I think what I was hoping for at UCLA was definitely to try to find a way to have a more productive space to work through this interest with queerness and technology and computation. And, you know, I wanted to like work on building skills more, but also I just wanted the time, you know, in these environments to just experiment and figure out where I'm going to go. I don't know. It was really, really open. Also, I was so young. You know, I did my MFA at 20. I think I started when I was 24. I remember the first studio was like a disaster and I absolutely hated it. I actually really actively was considering dropping out. But I met a really important person, which, is the media theorist and scholar in Catherine Hales. And she had been affiliated with Design Media Arts. But her home department was English.
N. Catherine Hales has had an illustrious career. She taught at Caltech, Dartmouth, and eventually came to UCLA in 1992, where she taught here until 2008 in the departments of English and DMA. She has written several acclaimed books, such as How We Became Post-Human, Virtual Bodies in Cybernetics, Literature and Informatics, and more recently, Postprint, Books and Becoming Computational.
I just remember, you know, I wrote to her and I said, you know, I'm really interested in learning more about, you know, media theory and philosophy. And she let me do an independent study with her. And then I took her graduate seminar and she really just opened up this whole world to me. It's like I learned about Alan Turing and queer histories of computation. I think she just brought a certain kind of like conceptual theoretical rigor that I was like really starving for, that I wanted to kind of infuse my practice. And she gave me a lot of confidence to pursue that. And I think, you know, funny enough, like wouldn't say it was an artist like at DMA, it was a theorist that like actually like unlocked major things for me at UCLA. And she's definitely the most important figure. And then, you know, actually as time went on, I started to get this sense that there was much wilder, intriguing things happening at UC San Diego. And I had this thought because in my first year, I saw the artist Ricardo Dominguez speak at UCLA in one of the DMA lecture series. And I remember it was like a Cupid's arrow going through my heart, seeing Ricardo speak. I mean, I will never forget it ever, ever. I mean, it was like one of these things where I just felt like, oh my God, this is what I'm looking for.
And what was he saying? Like, what was he saying that?
I mean, he just did this very performative lecture where he wore this balaclava and it was like partially inspired by the Zapatistas in Mexico and his work with them. And it was a lot about like, you know, like hacktivism, you know, which was like a big thing at the time. And I think it was just this mixture of politics, of thinking, like really imaginative, but also like rich conceptual thinking, and how that's coming in and informing a practice, it just really, really spoke to me. And I, you know, reached out to Ricardo and like kind of started working with him on the side. Actually, it's funny, like this is reminding me of even, I felt like my education in LA was all about like being on the fringes, because, you know, Catherine Hales had this like, you know, partially in, partially out of DMA. Ricardo's down in San Diego. But then the other huge person for me was actually Jack Halberstam. Jack Halberstam is a queer theorist, and Jack Halberstam taught at USC. But I really wanted to be studying with a queer theorist, and I reached out to Jack, and we met at USC, and Jack started meeting with me at like coffee shops and like Silver Lake and maybe Highland Park, and did this kind of like queer theory training on the side. And I feel like that was a lot of my UCLA, like the most important things for me during that time were just with these figures on the periphery.
With support and inspiration from Hales, Halberstam, and Dominguez, I asked Zach what his artwork looked like at this stage in his career.
I was really influenced by the graphic design elements that were coming out of DMA, because, you know, the undergraduate program there is more design oriented, where the graduate program is more, you know, focused on being an artist. And I had just done different TAing for, you know, different classes that really forefronted graphic design. And I never really paid much attention to that because, again, my education just hadn't really taken me there. But I think looking at graphic design, thinking about all these different interests I had, getting exposed to hacktivism, I started to develop this work that I ended up calling Queer Technologies. And that was this project that was just, you know, looking at different ways that queerness might relate to computation. And, you know, for instance, I imagined this like queer programming language that was based on a history of queer slang languages used throughout the 20th century. I created this software user's manual that was called Gay Bombs, which was like dealing with different ways gay bombs have been imagined, like whether through the US military, where they had made a proposal to create this biochemical weapon that would turn enemy combatants gay, or I'd also done work with gender changers, which were, you know, kind of thinking about how like wire plugs gendered male and female based on pinhole configuration. And I did a work that just kind of played with that in different gender configurations. And, you know, the way that work materialized was so much like a graphic design project, because I wanted these things to look like real technologies that you could, or products that you could buy. And so I created these works to, yeah, look like if they were in an electronic store, they might be something that you might want to buy. And I think, you know, that happened through a mixture of, you know, DMA and working with Jack Halberstam and talking with Ricardo Dominguez. And then I like ended up shop dropping them in stores around Los Angeles, which is, you know, like putting these products in these stores secretly, because I wanted people to have these encounters with these objects outside of an art context and like actually pick them up and be like, what would I use this for? But yeah, I think to summarize, you know, I think that work was very much about like what could queerness look like if it's thinking about normativity and anti-normativity within a computational technical context. Like that's what I was really interested in.
After graduating from UCLA in 2008, Zach wanted to stay in LA. However, he also wanted to be a professor like his mentors. Hales encouraged him to pursue a PhD, but he wasn't sold on the idea at first.
Like, Catherine Hales was like, you should do a PhD. And I remember just thinking, that's odd. Why? I was like, why would I do that? And, you know, she was like, oh, I really think that, you know, with your theoretical interest that, you know, this could be incredibly productive for you. And, you know, you should just really consider it. And, you know, the more that she talked with me about it, I mean, I'm super grateful, you know, that she saw this potential in me. She pushed me to apply to PhD programs, and which of course I had to do after my first year of UCLA, because, you know, the time frame for applying, getting into progress, it was like really intense and chaotic. I remember feeling just like, oh my God, like what is happening? I'm only like 1 year into this MFA program. But, you know, she was amazing. And I remember to write my sample paper for PhD applications, you know, my I was just thinking, like, I was such an artist, not a scholar, and I wanted to write about things that didn't exist because, you know, that's the work I wanted to make. And she was really influenced and, you know, admired different sci-fi writers, like such as like Borges, for instance. And in the style of Borges, she was like, well, you know, why don't you imagine a set of artworks and then write a critical essay on them? You know, do that. And I remember thinking, no one's going to admit me to a PhD program. You want me to like imagine these artworks and then like write a critical essay? I was like, who's going to say yes to that? And she was like, you know, this is perfect because it'll be like a great filter, right? If they don't let you in, it's going to be probably too conservative and too traditional for you.
Zach did just that. He wrote a critical essay about fictional works. He was shocked to discover he got into USC and UC Berkeley. He started his PhD at Berkeley, but the program wasn't a good fit. Hales around this time began to teach at Duke University in North Carolina. She encouraged him to join her there, but this meant he had to leave California, where he had hoped to live and work.
So I left California. It was traumatic leaving, very sad. I hated living in the Bay Area. Like, I mean, I was such an LA person. I mean, I was just so angry that whole year in San Francisco. Like, it was and anyway, I moved to North Carolina, and it was a change for sure. But my time at Duke was incredible, and like, it was amazing. It was everything I wanted out of a PhD program. And you know, and I got to continue working with Catherine Hales, which was kind of wild and unexpected, you know, that I studied with her for 5 more years at Duke.
And while you're in this PhD program, are you producing artwork still, or is it predominantly research?
Yes, in fact, I made the work that is currently on view at Pacific Standard Time while I was doing my PhD at Duke. And that work in Pacific Standard Time was my dissertation.
Zach is included in the LACMA exhibition, Digital Witness: Revolutions in Design, Photography, and Film. Presented as part of PST Art, formerly Pacific Standard Time, this iteration of Getty's landmark regional event explores the theme of art and science colliding. Also included in Digital Witness are a dozen other UCLA Arts community members, including alumni, staff, and both past and present faculty, such as Rebecca Allen, Jennifer Steinkamp, Casey Riaz, Lee Mulliken, Valerie Green, Lucas Blaylock, and more. Digital Witness opens November 24th and will be on view through July 13th, 2025.
My dissertation at Duke was on theories of opacity, which, you know, really about thinking about different ways that minoritarian people might want to refuse visibility, refuse recognition. And, you know, I was particularly interested in thinking about that around biometric facial recognition at the time. You know, very little work had been done around facial recognition when I started this project in like 2009, 2010.
Zach's work in Digital Witness, Facial Weaponization Suite, protests against biometric facial recognition and the inequalities these technologies propagate by making collective masks in workshops that are modeled from the aggregated facial data of participants. More recently, in late 2023, Zach debuted Cultus in London, the second part in a trilogy. This immersive multimedia exhibition combines so many of his interests: technology, film, music, and horror. It's a sensory overload in the most fantastic way.
But it's really looking at, you know, belief systems, political views, ideologies. I'm interested in like beliefs and fantasies and, you know, political philosophical systems that kind of undergird the Californian tech industry and how those things influence technical development, marketing, and also just like the kind of visions of the future that are attached to these technologies. And Cultus is part 2 in this trilogy, and it was looking at AI religiosity. And, you know, really that's just about like thinking about and looking at all the different ways AI is imbued with like senses of the religious. And, you know, this could be something as direct as religious organizations forming in California around worshiping coming AI gods. Or it could be just, you know, making comparisons to artificial intelligence as something godly. And so the work was really about trying to kind of surface that and present that very, very directly in this like kind of intense, visceral way where like these AI gods are conjured through these like bodily offerings and conjuring songs. And there's this like heretical presence in the installation that is like, you know, countering the force of these AI gods. And I think it's really about, you know, the work is about staying within this belief system that's emerging around AI and kind of thinking, like engaging that as a kind of ongoing political struggle, you know, in cultists, right? It's like these gods and this heretical force and presence.
I don't know.
You know, cultists is one of these works. I could say so much about it. So it's everything in like six kitchen sinks. You know, it takes a while.
That's why I'm so particularly drawn to it, especially having talked to you now, because it feels like it brings all of these interests of yours together. It brings technology, AI, video art, horror. It brings it all into one place that feels very uniquely you. And what's next? You know, where do you want the series to go next?
I mean, I would love to be able to show all of these works together, like if it's ever plausible once they're all done. But I mean, maybe like, you know, what I could say about that is like, you know, I work more like a director these days. Like that's also how films come around where, I mean, these productions are really big. They take a year and I'm often working with like 50 to 60 people to make these works, you know, where I have like a computer graphics team, a sound team. You know, I work with architects, different types of fabricators, actors. You know, I worked with like 5 actors and I was one of the actors in Cultists. I worked with like a team of musicians and singers. It really is, you know, massive production. And I think that just kind of taps into my, I think, training with film and directing. And I really like working that way. And I think, you know, trying to make it this scale, like it's just, you do have to bring on different, and I really like work. I mean, I've always liked working this way. This is why I wanted to do film first. Like I'm not very interested in the lone artist, like, you know, kind of in the studio. I'm much more receptive to working in this style, and it presents its own obstacles because, you know, work can take a while because you have to, you know, raise funds and find, you know, usually multiple museums to present these works. But I think it's, you know, it's what I want to do. I find it deeply rewarding. And yeah, right now I'm trying to work on part 3, which is about the apocalypse, the end of the world. It's about tech figures like Peter Thiel or Mark Zuckerberg building bunkers, doomsday bunkers in Hawaii and New Zealand. And it's kind of about like this neo-colonial view of, kind of Oceania, these places, Hawaii, New Zealand, and Island. Another one is Nauru, and thinking about this kind of like neo-colonial claiming of the land, and also just about, you know, different narratives about the end of the world and apocalypse, with tech elite thinking they're going to escape this by building these bunkers. So, I mean, I'm really just in the early stages of research and kind of pre-production development. So it'll be a while, but that's what I'm doing now.
You've been listening to Works in Progress, a podcast from the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. You can find previous episodes on our website at podcast.arts.ucla.edu. I'm Sean Arenas. Thanks for listening and take care.